This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Book Waves, Art Waves programs on KPFA-FM and Pacifica Syndication. Werner Vinge, who died on March 20th, 2024 at the age of 79, was one of the masters of late 20th century and early 21st century science fiction. He won 5 Hugo Awards, 3 for Best Novel and 2 for Best Novella, and is credited as the first science fiction writer to offer a fictional cyberspace a few years before William Gibson or Neal Stephenson. On May 7, 1992, Richard A. Lupoff and I interviewed Werner Vinge while he was on tour for his novel, Fire Upon the Deep, which would be co-winner of the Hugo Award for Best Novel at the 1993 World Science Fiction Convention. Overall, Werner Vinge wrote 8 novels and had 5 published collections of his writings. His final novel, The Children of the Sky, was published in 2011.
This is Probabilities. I'm Richard Walensky with my co-host Richard A. Lupoff. Our guest is Werner Vinge, science fiction writer, author of a number of novels, including Tatya Grimm's World, The Witling, True Names and Other Dangers, Threats and Other Promises, The Peace War, Marooned in Real Time, and his most recent novel is called A Fire Upon the Deep. Now, you're a mathematician, is that correct?
I have a doctorate in mathematics. I've been teaching computer science the last few years.
Do you deal specifically in things like virtual reality?
No, actually, my thing is more like computer networks. I've managed to avoid the virtual reality when it comes to the real reality of my job.
I was wondering, in fact, before we started this interview, having looked over my notes and looked over your biography, pardon my naivete, but what does a professional mathematician do? I got this odd picture of somebody sitting at a desk adding up columns of figures all the time. That's a bookkeeper.
Mathematics at a level like at a university actually has a lot of breadth. I was very surprised when I was taking courses. You kind of think, well, you take trigonometry and then you take calculus and then – well, what is there?
Right. Is that the end of it? Or
actually, at that point, things begin to spread out horizontally as well as spread out in depth. So there is just a vast array of different, very esoteric things. Things like calculus is actually an elementary topic in the sense that it's a freshman-sophomore topic. You get things like knot theory. It's just a study of knots and how one knot is similar to another knot. General studies of shapes, those are all very, very interesting things. There are things that are very immediate, obvious importance, like signal processing, signal detection, things like that obviously have a very great meaning to some people who have lots of money to spend.
What about fractals?
Fractals are an interesting development of the last 15 years that, to me, take – many of the discoveries that were made in the 19th century that were unvisualizable but were understood by people sufficiently smart and with computer means of visualization have made them accessible to people who are ordinary smart.
What exactly is a fractal? My idea is that it's kind of a visual impression of a very, very complex equation. Is that correct?
I think that's a fair overview. Fractals come up in many, many different ways and is probably not I certainly don't have a single characterization for them. But in the 19th century, there was often the notion that the universe was this great watch, God's watch. Toward the end of the 19th century, there were some very controversial fellows who pointed out there were all sorts of situations where if you followed the nice stuff, you wound up with these things that have interior replication and the sorts of things that we now visualize very easily with fractals. One of the most famous ones was by a guy named Weierstrass, who came up in the 19th century with a curve that is something you could draw with a piece of chalk without lifting the chalk from the blackboard that did not have a tangent. You could not draw a tangent to this curve at any point. Now, if you think of a curve that you can draw without lifting the chalk from the blackboard, it's very difficult for most people to imagine being able to draw one that is so ragged that at no point can you draw a tangent to it. And in fact, he incurred wrath of those around him because the very idea was inimical to kind of notions of what aesthetic reality should be. By the way, this is a curve that you can see in fractal books now if you go and look.
What does it look like?
I think it's very similar to the K-O-C-H, which I don't know how to pronounce, Koch, snowflake or something like that. It's done as an approximation. You can only show it in better and better accuracy, which is the case of almost everything that really qualifies as a fractal. You draw a straight line with a triangular jog in it. And then on each of the four segments of that line, you repeat that experiment. That's step two. And then on all of the remaining segments, you repeat that experiment. That's step three. And
you continue this indefinitely.
And the curve is the limit of all those, of that family of curves.
You're a science fiction writer, okay? And we know about fractals a little bit. Where could you go with fractals? I mean, could you eventually, say, create an equation and the moment you finish writing it, a person pops up next to you or something?
I have really avoided there is a subgenre of science fiction, mathematical science fiction, usually more humorous and fantastical than straight science fiction. And I've really avoided writing that. And I think part of the reason is I had to work so hard to get this stuff straight in my own head that I'm uneasy doing fanciful, patently untrue things with it. And so actually I have not done any of that sort of stuff. I have been encouraged to, but I haven't been able to.
Well, I think the question that both Richard Walensky and I have buzzing through our brains at this moment, as fascinating as what you tell us about mathematics, which has always struck me as being either boring or impenetrable, and I compliment you on making it both interesting and comprehensible. I mean, that is
Thank you.
Major achievement, Werner Vinge. But the next logical question for us today is, how do you move from that, which strikes me as a very abstract conceptual field, into something like being a science fiction writer?
Well, I have always been very, very interested in science fiction, and I always was interested in math. My big pitch for math is that if you don't know what you want to do, but you do want it to be in a hard science, stick with math. And I think that's probably true up to some point in early graduate school.
And why is this?
Because it is the language that all the hard sciences talk in. So if you don't know what you want, you keep taking science courses and you study, but you keep taking math as your central issue. You don't know what you want to do. When the time comes, and you better make up your mind before you start a PhD program, I would say, but when the time comes to decide, you can jump off in another direction, even economics, but physics, chemistry. If you've been taking other courses along the way, you can jump off with less pain than, say, if you had targeted on just one of those and then decided you wanted something at the other end of that family of things. So I was always interested in science, but I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was a dilettante, you know, never learned anything very well, but I had misconceptions about everything. And at a certain point, I realized I was never going to get any better, and I really liked the math, so I stayed with that. All along, I had been writing science fiction, and I wrote science fiction, when I was 10. I wrote science fiction when I was 18, and about that time, I started selling.
What did you read when you were that age? Did you read all of them, the Heinlein, the Asimov?
Oh, the Heinlein. I am told that I was a slow reader, that I didn't learn to read until the second grade, that the first thing I read was Between Planets by Robert Heinlein. So it was like a gift to the mentally handicapped, that story, that it made it possible for me to break out and learn to read.
When did you first sell?
I think it was 64 or 65. The first story I sold was actually to New Worlds, a British magazine. It wasn't the first story I ever wrote that sold, but there was a couple stories that came kind of bang, bang right there.
And now over the years, even though you have a good reputation and You know, you're one of those science fiction writers whose novels come out in hardback first. There are very few. What's the story?
I have a full-time job, of course. Given the success of some of the stories, I've been encouraged to write full-time. But I do like what I am doing with my job, enjoy that very much. There's also other questions. One is, if you're writing one book or two books every year, as opposed to writing one book every 3 years, I really have fears of what would happen. It's much easier to, it seems to me, to have lots of neat ideas well developed if it's at a slow rate than a fast rate. And I would defer to people who have done both to know for sure. I think it depends on the person. But I really kind of worry what would happen if I was under the gun. I really admire journalists and other people who have to write under the gun. It's a good learning experience, but I don't know what would happen to me.
I discovered Werner Vinge with a book, a story. It was not a book. It was half of a double, I believe, called True Names, which was, insofar as I know, one of the very first examples of a virtual reality computer construct that exists in fiction.
Mm-hmm.
It came out a couple of years before Neuromancer, mm-hmm, by William Gibson, which is what everybody remembers. And it takes place in a magical universe controlled inside a computer. Where did the idea, from your perspective, of virtual reality come from? And is the current idea, say, is exemplified in Lawnmower Man, kind of, do you feel that you're sort of the daddy of that?
I haven't seen Lawnmower Man, so I can't speak to that. But the thing in True Names was certainly not called cyberspace. It was also not called virtual reality, but it was the notion of a reality that I call the other plane, I think, that existed across the worldwide computer net that people could participate in. And it's a little bit like virtual reality. It's a little bit more like consensual reality, such as the Habitat stuff that has been done. The idea came from two places. One, in the early 70s, I had read Ursula Le Guin's fantasy trilogy, Earthsea, which brought up a notion that you see in fantasy of true names giving you power over. And it occurred to me that I always, whenever I read a fantasy, I try to think of it, how could this be a science fiction story? And it occurred to me that if you knew something's serial number, you might have power over it if there was a sufficiently large database that described everything. That was about 1971, and that hung fire for a long time. And then around 1979, I decided I was going to write True Names. And at that time, we had a computer network at San Diego State, which is where I teach. And I was logged on, you know, doing my schoolwork, and I was accosted by another user who wanted to talk, which is possible. It was possible even then to talk as via teletypes. And neither of us wanted to reveal to the other who we were. And I told him I was Mr. Slippery. And we chatted for a while. And I had other things to do. And after we had typed four or five interchanges, I said something like, well, basically, I am a personality simulator program like Eliza. And I've just about run out of my span of chit-chat that it would fool anybody. So I have to go. And I ended the conversation. And after that conversation, I realized that by the standards of my entire life, I had just lived a science fiction story. And with just an extremely small amount of window dressing, it could be turned into a regular story. Not that particular incident, but the milieu.
Well, the other element of True Names reminded me of kind of Dungeons and Dragons fantasy games as well, that if you were to combine that element and the computer, you'd sort of wind up with True Names. Were you involved with any of those kinds of games?
No, and I think that we're talking about 1979 and 1980. I had not had any contact. I think I knew about Avalon Hill, but I had not. I don't think I'd ever played an Avalon Hill game, and I certainly had not played sorts of ten games that there were in some dormitories and stuff. So I don't see that as being there. But again, this is far enough back that we'd have to look at what was actually current at that time.
Werner, you mentioned habitat. I don't know how many of our listeners are familiar with that. Would you fill us in briefly?
Habitat, and I can't remember organizational names well enough to do a good job, but a fellow named Chip Morningstar and Randy Farmer.
That's up at Lucasfilm, or at least was at one time.
That's what I thought.
Yes.
And they built what they call a consensual reality, and I think that's the term they use, and they use it as a contrast to virtual reality. Consensual reality is where you allow people to get together on a network, and the reality is there to make the interaction between the people convenient and perhaps entertaining. And so what they had, some marvelous ideas, such as subscribers could have very small computers. I think they were Commodores. And they had very small or weak, not powerful modems, 300 bits per second modems. And they used some wonderful tricks, for instance, have the computer know what different things look like. So if you want to say the picture is you standing by a door next to a stone wall, that could be done with like 3 or 4 bytes of information. Because what would come down is sort of ID codes for what I just said in words, which probably conveyed an image in your mind that was quite detailed. The same thing was done inside the Commodore. Those words came down as codes, and inside the Commodore, there were pictures of stone walls and doors and you.
Well, sure. That's ingenious, but it's in another sense, it's very obvious. If we say the word Buick, you know what a Buick is.
Right.
I don't have to go into a long oration on describing this vehicle. One word conveys it.
True. This sort of thing can be set up remotely, and it persists, and it's shared at all the sites. So a large computer at the central site is maintaining a very elaborate reality. They had an entire landscape with property development going on and an economy. What was manifested at the individual sites could be done with a very low communication bandwidth. And I think it was very, very successful. And I saw it in operation. It was incredibly impressive that something as simple as a Commodore could give you that feeling of reality.
And as I recall, we may not have seen the same demonstration, but it was the same system. I recall on one event that characters, that is, users who logged on, mm-hmm. could have fictitious personae in the Habitat system.
And definitely.
I think it was Chip Morningstar, in fact, you mentioned him, told me that they had a priest who had a priest persona.
Yes.
But of a different religion, oddly enough, of an invented religion rather than one that we know in the real world. And two of the other fictitious personae wanted to get married, and they had a little wedding right there in this consensual reality.
In the end, they discovered that I think virtually all behaviors in the real world could be meaningful there, virtually all behaviors. And in some cases, they found economic things. In other words, right now, things like groupware are kind of buzzwords, ways of getting serious software to allow serious groups to manage large projects. This stuff really has that potential, because if you set it up and model it right and actually introduce an economics, you could regard it as a surrogate economic reality, as opposed to having ticker tapes and stock markets and getting on the phone for a conference call.
Between True Names and Fire Upon the Deep, you wrote two interrelated novels, Peace War and Marooned in Real Time. Two questions. First, you used stasis fields.
Mm-hmm.
That came out of Heinlein, right?
Stasis fields have been around from many, many different authors. It'd be interesting to try to push it back and find the first one. In a sense, even something like The Sleeper Wakes would qualify. Heinlein did Door into Summer, where he had suspended animation. Is that the stasis fields that are rather like force fields are something that Larry Niven has done a lot with.
And you use it in terms of creating a world where the power of those in charge derives from their stasis.
Werner Finchi, let me ask you to define a stasis field, because you know we're talking up here on this high science fiction level. A lot of our listeners are not science fiction fans, right. And about at this point they're saying, "Wait a minute, I'll take peanut butter."
Yes,
come on.
Well, I think one point is good. That this is high science fiction. It's not high science. A stasis field is a science fictional notion of a area like the inside of a room or the inside of some of a 3 yard wide ball, where time is either slowed down or it has stopped. By the way, in this story, that was something that was not – these were thought of as just force fields because nothing could get inside. And one thing that very much surprised the characters in the book was when they found that actually they time stopped inside. And then when the stasis field burst, terminated, you'd have the Rip Van Winkle effect, or you could simply regard it as a way of storing crops – and a plentiful year, instead of silos, you could just, you know, put these things in stasis fields. So they had multitudinous uses.
The government there is not particularly pleasant. Do you feel that that's the future then, or is that just science fiction?
Oh, the Peace War had an unpleasant government which had come to power in what was looked like a worldwide coup that involved all sorts of very unpleasant things, and that is certainly not was not intended as a prediction. It was a post-apocalyptic thing where it looked like these guys may have set it up. In the second and third parts of the sort of trilogy, the baubles were used in a much more extravagant way as a means of traveling down time extraordinarily large distances.
And yet in an essay about you by Patrick L. McGuire, that's the one in 20th Century Science Fiction Writers, McGuire comments at length on what he calls the very bleak outlook of your fiction. Do you have any response to that?
Have to look at particular stories, I guess, to really comment on it. I do not regard my fiction as bleak. I think just as with Atomic Power, there are some very scary things that are possible, but the Peace War certainly has an optimistic ending, and so does Marooned in Real Time. But I certainly I just came from a meeting where several people were telling me how bleak it seemed, not by comparison with other science fiction writers, but in some sort of absolute sense. I really like happy endings, and I think that most of my stories are relatively mellow.
Well, I think this raises a problem which I've encountered in the past with other authors and, in fact, people who commented on my own fiction on occasion in this context, and that is the difference or potential difference between the author's intention and the reader's perception.
Yes. I think that there's – first of all, as a matter of unpleasant fact, it's very easy – it's much easier to seem like an author who really has a firm grasp on the hard realities to write downers. And so there's always kind of a temptation to that, especially if you want to have emotional effect. The easiest way to get emotional effect is to have something bad happen to characters that you've made people care about.
Sure, we're going to murder this beautiful child before
yes.
your very eyes, viewer. Ah, you know,
and I
saw a movie a while ago yes. in which they did that, and I almost left the theater. I was so outraged by the
right.
manipulation that was going
and
on.
I think both you and I understand that well enough that we go to great lengths to avoid it. Nevertheless, if you're trying to write intense stuff, there will be times when you do things that are uncomfortable. I read give me the exact title, the Space Blues down in Little Old New
Space
Alabama.
Oh, Space War Blues.
Yes. I love that story. I think we're about the same age, but I think I was pretty young when I read it. And that really was intense to me. It was the one that was – at that time, it was just kind of at my outer edge of being able to really love the story. And part of it was that it was so intense, but it was also right near the edge where if it had been more at that time in my life anyway, I would have, you know, had trouble.
One final question about these books. They came out – Peace War came out in hardback from Blue Jay Books, as did Marooned in Real Time. Yet when it came out in paper, it came out as one volume and there was something in the middle called The Ungoverned.
Ah.
Yeah. What's all this about?
They both came out in paperback also. Several years after that, Jim Bain took the three stories that I've written in that future and put them together into one paperback with a very nice cover that brings them all together, and that's called Across Real Time. The middle story is a bridge story between the two parts and an excursion into anarcho-capitalism, but still in the future, and it really sets the stage for the main character in the third story.
Is it absolutely necessary to read it to enjoy Marooned in Real Time?
Oh no. I'm glad that Jim Bain brought all three, though. They hang together very well, but these are definitely independent.
Which now brings us to the new book, A Fire Upon the Deep. Dick
you
Nikoff.
Go first, or I go first?
You go first.
Okay. This new book is a long and very ambitious book. Actually, Richie has read the book very thoroughly, and my time was limited. I was only able to skim it, for which I apologize. But even from a superficial look at it, you're dealing with a universe in which there are multiple species,
yes,
intelligent species, in a gigantic interstellar or even intergalactic civilization. This, of course, is very traditional science mm-hmm. fiction. Goes back to Doc Smith, Edmund Hamilton, and Jack Williamson, and people 70 years ago.
Right.
But I wonder if you think there is a serious likelihood of such a universe with multiple intelligent species.
Not the particular model in this story, because there's a major gimmick that forces things to go in a certain way. But the general question of life elsewhere in the universe, I believe that there is. I also believe that what happens to all races such as ourselves is if they survive, they very quickly become more than human. And to me, that's the most likely explanation for the paradox that we have the tools to detect human-like civilizations at fairly great removes right now, and we haven't detected such. One explanation is that they have graduated. That was kind of the theme in Marooned in Real Time, and that is my personal best bet as to why we haven't seen a lot of extraterrestrials ourselves.
And we encounter this debate fairly often of people like Carl Sagan, of course, who has worked out all sorts of mathematical
yes.
formulas, which even tell us that there are exactly 42,600,000 so and so. I remember when I first read his interpolations in Shklovsky's book, Intelligent
yes.
Life in the Universe, I saw that formula and I was very impressed. And then I read more carefully and I discovered, well, that's fine, except several of the factors are just numbers that he's picking
out of
the air.
To me, this has been one of the more interesting kind of intellectual journeys of the 20th century, this question of other intelligences. And that point about that formula, as what you've said, is absolutely important point. There's been some other developments in the meantime, namely, I think principally a fellow named Tipler looked at the formula again and said, let's suppose some of these factors are really small, and pointed out that even if there were one or two races that existed, if they were interested in colonization, you could show that in a geologically short period of time, like 100 million years, that's not short geological, but it's within a geological
yes.
time frame, that all the habitable worlds in the galaxy would be settled by that one race, a la Asimov's Future, for instance. That was like upping the ante. That turned the entire issue around and intensified the paradox issue, so that now, in some ways, the most modern of the people who think about that really do figure that there is nothing else, because not only would we have detected it, we probably wouldn't exist because we would have been overrun while we were still, before humanity really arose.
Well, what if we were a colony who forgot our source?
That would be a possibility, although I think a lot of these people, and really myself, would argue that would, unless it were deliberately disguised, that would be pretty easily detectable by us now.
A Fire Upon the Deep contains a rather unusual species, dog-like creatures who operate in packs, and the packs function as a single entity.
Yes.
Reminds me a little bit, are you familiar with the work of a man named Hinze?
No.
Okay. Then I'll drop that line of questioning because he has beings who are two beings who have each have their own separate personality, and then together they have a third.
So the science fiction writer.
Science fiction writer. Yeah, I'll give you the name of the book off the air. But anyway, drop that section and I'll edit it out. Where did you come upon the idea of creating packs with single intelligences? Is there anything on Earth like that?
So there are some things very vaguely like that, including us if you count the two hemispheres of our brain. It's certainly – my chief inspiration has probably been the fact that it's been done in science fiction so often. I didn't recognize the reference that you brought up, but there's all sorts of references. Super minds, supergroup minds are very common, Stapledon and on. Paul Anderson has written stories about group minds that the parts were subhuman but the whole was human level. And that's the situation in this story. So in my idea box for many years, I said, this is a parameterized problem. You can tweak the number of critters that make up one group mind, you know, two or three up to zillions. And you can tweak the intelligence that the group as a whole has. In fact, I think Michael Swanwick gave a great talk once about a group mind that was stupider than its parts. It was hilarious. In my case, I decided to have group minds in the range from 4 to 8. The individuals were slightly smarter than dogs. Together, they were essentially a human-level intelligence. And I was just amazed at how much rich stuff there was still left in that. It was – that part of the story was just a joy to write. It was so easy. For instance, there are so many cliches in English that I could just use and they suddenly had sparkling new meaning like, I'm of two minds on that issue or I'm a little bit pregnant or why don't you tell your conscience to take a walk? And it just kind of went on and on. I kind of had to rein it in at times because ordinary English cliches suddenly had significance.
Had you got any input, do you think, from Frank Herbert, The Green Brain I'm thinking of specifically?
I don't think I've read The Green Brain, but I have read a fair amount of his. Probably Stapledon and Paul Anderson had a Dominic Flandre story in which he had size 3 group minds.
And you also have a universe that has stupid and smart segments.
Right. Yes. As one of my as an editor pointed out, they could call this one of the fundamental discoveries here is that we're all living in the stupid part of the universe. The idea here was driven by what we were talking about earlier, that in my opinion, progress is very soon going to allow us to make superhumanly intelligent things. And that means that space opera as we have known and loved it is really not very plausible, not because it's impossible, but because the players will be superhuman. So I wanted to come up with a way to have a interstellar adventure that would not contradict what I feel appears to follow from the physical law that we have. I'm not the only person, in my opinion, nowadays who is trying to write stories that work around that problem. I think Ian Banks' stories in his own way work around that problem. And my solution was to turn the problem of progress, to rotate the problem of progress out of the time dimension by assuming, just as you said, that in our part of the universe, for reasons that are only vaguely discussed, in our part of the universe, it is not possible to make superhumanly intelligent machines or people for that matter. That doesn't mean that we are super smart but suppressed. It just means that we can't make things that are smarter. There is a part of the universe that is called the transcend in this story where superhumanly intelligent beings can be made and can exist. In between those two zones, which roughly follow levels of galactic matter density, between those two levels, you can't make superhumanly intelligent life, but you can have faster than light drive. So if you take, say, Larry Niven's future history, he has, over a period of time, stories about sublight travel and then superlight travel is discovered and so on. In this future universe, they all exist, but they're partitioned geographically or telegraphically, so to speak. For instance, there is an area that's worse than where we are. The galactic center turns out is called the unthinking depths because creatures of human intelligence cannot exist there. And we, of course, on Earth don't know about this and won't ever. That's the hypothesis because we're stuck on Earth. People who do interstellar exploration, the ones who accidentally go in the right direction, will end up in the area where faster-than-light travel can be invented, and they will invent it. The poor, unhappy people that decide to explore the galactic core, you know, looking for science fiction's elder races, they run off into the unthinking depths, and those expeditions don't come back.
And they get stupid when they're there, because they're in a stupid environment.
And that part is a little bit like the issue in Brainwave, Paul Anderson's Brainwave.
Exactly. Yes.
One difference between those two ideas is the idea that in his story, if the human people got out of the stupid part, they became smart naturally. That's not the case in my story. In my story, the idea is that smart things cannot exist here. We're not super smart, but sort of crushed down. We're just not super smart.
Pardon me for getting political, if you will, but is there a metaphor here to something in the contemporary real world, or is this strictly a science fictional concept?
I have written stories that had sort of political or anarchical overtones. This story, I think, is relatively free. Certainly, there's not much conscious intent. There are some overriding metaphors in the story, though. They are metaphors related to computer networks and distributed systems. The Tynes, the Packs, are a race that is very like a local area network. And at the other extreme, there's quite a bit about a wide area network that makes all our wide area networks look like very small potatoes.
There's comments from various races, what appears to be a giant intergalactic computer bulletin board.
Yes, it's very much like that. And although in one sense I worry about that because you think, oh boy, these people shouldn't sound like the nerds you see on a bulletin board. But the driving thing here is that the number of characters per second or bits per second that can be sent with the equipment is roughly like our bulletin board situation. And the time delays, even though they're using super light travel, the distances are very great. The time delays are roughly like our time delays are in the early 1990s. So the physical characteristics of the net have some similarities to the bulletin board situation. And that causes things to happen certain ways. One enormous difference is that we're talking about hundreds of millions of worlds, not just participants, but worlds. And many of them don't have common languages. They have computer interpretation programs in some cases. But basically, if you're different enough from another person, the computer the interpretation program may make the other side think you're making sense. In fact, that was my workaround for I'm not very good at writing about the unknowable. You don't write very well about the unknowable, and there's all sorts of unknowable in this story.
Death to vermin.
Right. But one way of backing out of this was saying, hey, this stuff is unknowable. What you are seeing here is our best shot at translating it. And oftentimes the translation sounds rather ordinary. It isn't until you kind of add it all up and you realize this guy on the other side is not making sense. I think he's seriously missed the point. And so that was the best I could do with the notion of unknowability.
We've been talking about specific works of science fiction, your mm-hmm. own works, Werner Vinge, and a few others that any of us have read and have referred to. But I wonder in a much broader sense if you feel that science fiction means something, means anything other than being pure entertainment.
I think I subscribe to a lot of what hard science fiction people think is good about science fiction, that it does give you the option of investigating scenarios, of looking at consequences. It provides a soapbox for almost every type of a political, emotional, or ecological belief. I mean, and I'm talking about radically conflicting notions coming from different authors. And that those are all good things. I read science fiction to enjoy it. And I think There are different ways of enjoying things. Sometimes I enjoy it because it does make a point, but I really do like stories that, besides making a point, have really interesting ideas and characters that I like.
In the 1980s, the so-called cyberpunk movement was quite sensational in the science fiction community, and even beyond it. Mm-hmm. I think some of the general media actually picked up on it. But that also seems to have been pretty much of a transitory phenomenon. Parts of it and the substance has been absorbed. The whole notion of the movement with, you know, with banners and placards has just totally disappeared. Here we are in the 1990s. Where is science fiction going now?
I think that the most substantial problem for science fiction is the fact that progress is accelerating, and Inside a Fire Upon the Deep is kind of my artistic answer to trying to write science fiction in an environment where I see progress accelerating to the point that we as humans can't talk about what goes on after a certain point in time. More and more, I see people in general that this point has percolated through, not because of any particular writer making the point, but it's like we're standing in the way of a tidal wave where progress just creates superhumanly intelligent creatures. And more, I think authors are responding to that. But it really, as a technical artistic problem, it's an intense problem. It's probably not the most important reason for the life cycle, as you describe it, for cyberpunk. But it is one thing. What do you do 10 years after the progress illustrated in a good cyberpunk novel? You're dealing with events that you can't talk about. So I think this is widely realized as a very intense problem, although it's quite a novel problem for artists or writers. And I have seen the understanding of it come up in very interesting places. I was on a panel with comic book artists, and I was very impressed by the amount of work they went to draw the gadgets. And this was superhero and science fictional type of comics.
Yes.
And one point that they made, in all seriousness, without me harassing or polemicizing, was that they clearly understood that if they tried to draw realistic things, they would not be impressive because they would probably be small. Their effects, they would just sort of silently do their spectacular effects. And this bothered them. And I see this as the same problem that I see in science fiction.
Then where does it go?
The where does it go question, actually, I don't worry too much about science fiction because I worry about it for our civilization as a whole. In other words, the science fiction aspect of it is simply sort of a harbinger of a general shadow of things to come. And this gets back to the pessimism or dark side that you were talking about,
Dick. I think bleak was the term that McManus used.
And that's what it's accused of, but I think the word apprehension might be better than bleakness. It's the outcome of being totally optimistic. If you're totally optimistic about how far progress can go, that means you're talking about things that otherwise in the past we viewed as something a million years from now in a golden age. You know, when humans make something better or become something better, that's not frightening because it's a million years away. It's when somebody starts talking about it happening 15 or 20 years from now that it suddenly you start feeling apprehensive. But it is optimism, probably more accurately than pessimism.
A Fire in the Deep is your most recent novel. You working on anything now?
Right now I have a number of ideas. One thing about The Fire in the Deep is it sets the mechanical stage for all sorts of things that would be very interesting to do. In fact, as a design question, that was part of what I had in mind. Not that this is part of a trilogy or something like that. It stands alone, but it's part of a universe that will be very easy to write stuff in.
A prequel to Fire Upon the Deep, titled A Deepness in the Sky, was published in 1999, and a sequel, The Children of the Sky, his last novel, was published in 2011. To date, none of his stories have been adapted for either television or film. You've been listening to an interview with the late science fiction master Werner Vinge, who died on March 20th, 2024, at the age of 79. It was recorded May 7th, 1992, in the KPFA studios, while on tour for the Hugo-winning novel Fire Upon the Deep. My co-host was Richard A. Luboff. This is the first time the complete interview has seen the light of day and was digitized, remastered, and edited in January 2025. Until next time, I'm Richard Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio Shows on Facebook.